Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Theogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I am joined by author Mike Marinacci, and we discuss his brand new book, Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches. And one of the reasons that I really was excited about having Mike on the show is, as I've mentioned here before on the podcast, I am looking to put together a new book, which would be an anthology of about psychedelic churches that use psychedelic sacraments that are new here in the United States. And Mike's book kind of does a nice job of encapsulating the history of psychedelic churches in the United States, going all the way back to the formation of the Native American church, and kind of gets all the way up to the year 2021. And I'm looking to do stuff that is now happening currently in the United States. There's been a lot of brand new entheogenic churches that have just started within the past couple of years, and even discuss with Mike possibly contributing a chapter to the book, kind of covering some of the history of psychedelic churches. But anyway, I mention all this because I am still looking for people who are interested in possibly being a contributor to the book. So this is just a broadcast offer out there that if there's anybody listening who is involved in a modern contemporary psychedelic church and would like to see my PDF info pack that contains the questions and the issues that I'm looking at, and for creating an entry for this anthology, just shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com, and I will send that PDF to you. And this is something that I'm looking to put out sometime, hopefully in the beginning of next year. So there's lots of time for people to create their entries. And like I said, hopefully going to work with Mike a little bit on this book as well. Before we get to the conversation with Mike, let's go ahead and do thanks and announcements. We'd like to thank Peter, who every once in a while stops by at PayPal and leaves a nice donation in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, and he has done so yet again over this past week. Thank you very much, Peter. Your support is very much appreciated. And also, just want to say thank you and welcome to Danielle. Had a consultation call with Danielle, helping her integrate her 5-MeO DMT experience the other night, and she decided that she wanted some ongoing support from me and interested in having at least a monthly call with me. So she signed up at the God Molecule level over at my Patreon page, which gets a 1-hour video call once a month. So thank you very much, Danielle. I enjoyed having our conversation the other day and look forward to working more with you. And for anybody out there who would either just like to support the podcast or come on at one of these top tier supporters and get a 30 or 60 minute video call once a month with me, I invite you to come on over to my Patreon page. There's everything from $1 a month up to $100 a month. It's a great way to support me and the podcast and get support for yourself in the process. And if you sign up at the $20 a month level and up, you get access to the full back catalog of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. And as I've mentioned, every time I upload a new episode, I have to delete an old one, and then it moves over to my Patreon page and is exclusively available for my top 4 tiers of patrons. So you can go to patreon.com/martinwball or go to my personal webpage at martinball.net and use either the PayPal link if you'd like to make a PayPal donation, or you can use the link over to my Patreon page and become a patron. Yay! Let's see. Also, just wanted to give a big thanks to Tom and Eden up in Portland, Oregon. I had a great time at the Sanctum Psychedelic Conference the other weekend. I didn't get to mention this on last week's episode because I recorded that before I went to the conference, but I had a great time up in Portland. Really enjoyed my time up on stage. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough time. I had 45 minutes and was trying to capture the last 15 years of history of 5-MeO DMT, and I thought I could do it in 45 minutes, but I definitely couldn't, and enjoyed the 2 to 3 hour talk that I had with people after my talk outside in the hot sun. But it was a lot of fun to be up in Portland, and just really want to thank Tom and Eden for inviting me to speak and being up on that stage. It was great. I'm very comfortable there. It's a place I like to be. I don't get a lot of opportunities to do that. So thank you so much, Tom and Eden. Really means the world to me. Also, just want to let everybody know that if you are interested, coming up this Thursday, August 3rd at 3 p.m. Pacific time, Magda Lazinski, who is featured in my 2022 Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT Anthology, is organizing a small online Q&A with me discussing 5-MeO-DMT, and it's going to be on Zoom. There is a cost for this. I think it's $35 Canadian, and anyone is welcome to join if you'd like to just get on the Zoom call, and you can bring whatever questions you have about 5-MeO-DMT, and we can talk about that, and we can talk about other things as well. You know, I'm not limited to that, but that's the main focus of the talk. If you just want to shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com, I can put you in touch with Magda. She's in charge of selling the tickets for that, but I can definitely connect you guys. And you can participate in the talk on Thursday. So perhaps I will see you there. Who knows? Okay, I think that that's about all that I have at the moment in terms of announcements and thanks. So let's go ahead and get into the talk with Mike Marinacci discussing his book, Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches. I really enjoyed reading it. I think you will as well. It's kind of a secret history. And we had a great conversation, so let's go ahead and jump on into it. Here it is. Okay, well, I am very excited to welcome on to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, Mike Marinacci. Did I say that correct, Mike?
Marinacci.
Marinacci.
Everybody makes that mistake.
Okay.
Sort of like marinara and, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Or mariachi, which is another one I've gotten, particularly growing up in Southern California, that becomes kind of a convoluted joke after a while.
Yeah, I could see how that would appear.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Mike is the author of a brand new book, Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches, LSD, Cannabis, and Spiritual Sacraments in Underground America. And as I shared with Mike just the other week before I started reading the book, that I told him that when this book arrived in the mail, because this is what happens to me as a podcast host, that I get lots of books in the mail, sometimes from authors, sometimes from publishers, sometimes from agents, and your book arrived in the mail. And I said, oh yeah, this one's going to the top of the list. And
thank you.
Yeah, not only because I'm interested in it, but it kind of dovetails with the new book project that I'm looking to work on, which is about really contemporary, like brand new entheogenic churches. And I thought, well, I want to read the whole history that Mike has got here. Like, this is perfect.
Oh, nice. Because really, I was looking, at the history up to about 2021, 2022. When, as you're probably aware, this field just exploded. I think part of it was the very rapid mainstreaming of psychedelic therapy, at least with psilocybin, and also the fact it's just so easy in the age of the internet to set up an organization where you're the only person, but you can just have you've just got a little circle of people, but you can look much bigger and more professional and more influential than you actually are. I mean, one thing I go into in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches is the fact that a lot of what I'm covering in there were fairly small organizations and fairly obscure. And I've had to do many years of digging to find some of these groups, but they were so interesting as far as their beliefs and practices and the people that led them and participated in them that I really wanted to put them in there right alongside the big boys like the Native American Church and Timothy Leary's various organizations and some of the other groups that I discuss in the book. So, I was, after I sent the manuscript to the publisher in early 2021. And of course, what happened right after that, all of these interesting groups started popping up that I'd never heard of. And very, you know, with controversies and things going on. And I'm glad somebody's kind of picking up the baton and running with it now to cover what's happening in the immediate present and near future.
Yeah, well, if this book project that I'm imagining actually comes to fruition, which hopefully will be sometime early next year, I'm definitely going to be referencing your book in it to say, if you want to get the backstory, if you want to get the history of what came before, definitely read this book. And it's just such a pleasure to see all of this information that there's a lot of stuff here in the book that I've kind of seen elsewhere, but it's all been sort of piecemeal. And there's also a lot here in the book that I haven't really seen before. And it's just so convenient to have all of this together in one place. And, you know, my longtime listeners will all know that, you know, I have my PhD in religious studies. And one of my complaints of being a religious studies graduate student was that we never had courses that dealt with the topic of entheogens in religion, either in any kind of contemporary sense or any kind of historical sense as well. And I think that this is a book that, I mean, it's not meant for a religious studies class per se, but it's relevant that this is part of American culture and history and North American culture and history. And it just, it hasn't been documented well before. And now, now you've done it. So huzzah.
Thank you. Thank you. It's something that I've been fascinated with for many years. I mean, to just give a little background about myself, I was raised in what was essentially a secular humanist background. And when I went away to college, UCLA, I started sampling entheogens of various kinds and had experiences that really kind of knocked me on my ass and said, well, this is what they've been talking about for thousands of years, about God and about the numinous experience and about mysticism and whatever. And in the mid-80s, I got very much interested in non-traditional religion and spirituality. And I found out that there was this weird subculture of churches and sects and circles that used cannabis and LSD and peyote and psilocybin and other substances as holy sacraments. They were very underground, of course, because of the legality issue. And I get into that in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches about the many, many leaked court cases that have been based on the First Amendment defense here, that one, that these groups claim that they have a religious right under the freedom of religion to use this as part of their practice. But as I said, it was very underground because this was the 80s and the Reagan era and the war on drugs, and it was very hard to contact any of these groups. Once the 90s rolled around and things started loosening up, I started collecting literature from various of these organizations and befriending some people in them. One of the people I had a long conversation with on the phone once was the late John Aiken, who founded the first non-Native American legally organized entheogenic sect in America called the Church of the Awakening. And the man was in his 80s at that time, but was still quite sharp and had a lot of very funny stories about his adventures there. But it's only in the last few years that I finally just said, look, this is this subject just seems to get hotter and hotter every year of psychedelics. You've got this special knowledge that nobody has really put and compiled into a book length format for a popular audience. The closest thing that anybody had done before me was Laurie Kozad's God on High, which is an academic book about cannabis oriented groups. And I was really interested in the full spectrum of all entheogens, of groups in North America that did that used everything from cannabis to LSD to the various synthetics to organic hallucinogens as their sacraments. So it took several years to write. I had an editor who I'm good friends with, who pitched it to Inner Traditions, and they ran with it, and I think did an excellent job in finally putting the whole thing together, along with my help as the writer. And I'm just very enthusiastic about it. I think it's easily the best thing I've ever written. I mean, it's my fifth book, but it just outshines all the others.
I got to say, having read it cover to cover, reading every page, it was just a delight to read this and to get all of this history. And again, I think it's just incredibly timely, because if this book were coming out, say, maybe 2 years from now, it might feel a little bit dated because, as we both mentioned, there is this explosion of new entheogenic churches that is just happening right now over the past couple of years. But with this coming out right now, it's kind of like the perfect, it leads right up until the 2021 era. So kind of like up into the beginning of the COVID era. And that it's quite interesting that a dot that I had not connected was when I spoke with Ian Benweis, who is a lawyer and also one of the founders of one of these new entheogenic churches. And he helps people fill out all the paperwork and do all the legwork to establish a legal entheogenic church. And I asked him, well, why do you think all of this is happening now? And his answer was COVID. He said, because of COVID and all the travel restrictions that happened, that people wanted to be able to consume their sacraments and have legal protections. And normally people would be, you know, going to Mexico, going to Canada, going down to South America. But with all the travel restrictions, that was what inspired people to actually do the work of establishing their church. So it seems like we have the pre-COVID era and now the post-COVID era. That's going to be one of these defining moments in history of how these churches have been operating.
Well, in the last chapter of part one, which is the part that covers the 18 groups that I really consider the major entheogenic churches as far as membership and influence and media coverage and legal battles that they've done, I get into the story of ayahuasca healings and Trinity de Guzman, who, when COVID hit, stopped having his, he was, for a short time, he and his cohorts were actually doing ayahuasca ceremonies in Washington State in a piece of land there. And then he got a little gun shy about, well, is the DEA going to approve this? Am I in trouble? So he went to Peru and opened up a retreat there. And once COVID hit, no more trips to Peru or Mexico or whatnot. So he did an online version of it, and complete with providing information on where people who took this course could get psilocybin sent to them from a South American country where it's legal. So yeah. And I think also just the more general thing is that COVID kind of stopped everything for a while.
Yeah.
And it forced all of us to kind of look at our lives, look at ourselves, look inward. And that's what really the core of the entheogenic experience is, as far as I'm concerned, is it looking, Cary Grant once said an interesting thing when he was talking about using then legal LSD, and somebody said, well, isn't that a drug? And he says, no, it's not a drug. It's a chemical. People who use drugs are running away from their lives. People who use chemicals are looking into them. This was the time I think a lot of us just looked into our lives, with family, with jobs, with our spiritual sides, with, how much time are we spending on the internet, believing everything, all the nonsense we see there, the TV, all the nonsense we see there. And it's set up a situation in North America and to a certain extent the world where people would be open to these experiences and open to once things got back to normal, whatever that is, they would gather and form communities around these experiences, which are at one point, at one level, very, very personal. On the other level, have been used as ways to bond a community and show a community a world beyond this, and a world that beyond the daily whatever we've dealt with for the last few thousand years. So it's I'm not surprised at all that it has really exploded, and I think COVID was a big part of it.
Yeah. So there's so many things here in the book that I want to talk about, but I do just want to invite you to share that you've already mentioned that this is, I think you said, your fifth book. So what were the previous projects that you worked on before getting into this very interesting subject?
Way back when I was a young'un at the in the very dawn of desktop publishing in the late 80s, when I was still in my 20s, I did a book called Mysterious California, which was sort of a travel guide to the the sort of weird and outre corners of the state, haunted houses, places where lake monsters and Bigfoot supposedly lived, cults, UFO sighting areas. And nobody really done anything like this in the U.S. They'd done books like this in Britain, and it was very much influenced by a book I loved when I was a teenager called Haunted Britain, which was sort of like a Fodor's haunted castles and mansions of old Blighty with these beautiful photographs. And it really, it self-published, did quite well. After that, I did a book called Weird California with two other gentlemen who were interested in this this sort of stuff. And I that was actually somewhat of a bestseller because it was published by Sterling Publications, which is Barnes & Noble's house publishing operation. Then California Jesus, which is a sort of examination of the Christian sects and evangelists who have either come out of or settled in my beautiful Golden State. And that was quite interesting and not a raving bestseller, but I think it really shined an area on both an aspect of California culture and the Christian faith that had not really been looked at before, which is why do you have these groups in this state and why are so many of them just really colorful or extreme in groups and individuals. I mean, I had a whole chapter in there about Amy Semple McPherson and another one about Gene Scott and these very real colorful maverick types. Then there was another one on Ronin Press called Eerie California, which is kind of a rehash of Mysterious California, and I wasn't real pleased with it. Then, of course, now I have my greatest work, which is Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches, and I am just, as I said, very excited about it. I really think it filled an area, a subject matter, or that nobody had really covered before. Just like nobody ever, way back when I was younger, nobody had ever done a ghosts and monsters tour guide to an American state or region. Nobody had ever really systematically looked at North American religious groups that use entheogens. So yeah, I'm, that's kind of what I led up to. I mean, I probably, if I was more disciplined and, enthusiastic about things and didn't have to work days, I would have written more books, but I'm just happy that this got out. I mean, I can die tomorrow and I'll just say, yeah, at least I got Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches out after decades of fascination with the subject and several years of putting it together.
Yeah. Well, it really fills a hole that no one else has filled in terms of really documenting and consolidating all of this history into one accessible mm-hmm. book that is well-organized, well-written. It's quite clear that you did an extensive amount of research that, I mean, I'm really interested just to ask you about that, about the process of getting all this information and then sorting it out and deciding how you're going to organize this book. And like, you know, I've been in the quote unquote psychedelic movement for years now, yeah. And there's a lot of stuff in here in this book that, like I said, I knew something about, but then there's a lot of things that, oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, I'd never heard of this group before, you know, both some larger things and also some more obscure things. And I guess part of what was a little bit surprising to me that, you know, I am a post 60s child, you know, I was born in 1972. And so the earlier psychedelic movement and hippie culture and all that was never a part of my life in any way. And I've never done a lot of readings. You know, I've never read Timothy Leary's books. I've never looked into that. I've been more interested in like what's going on now. It's kind of been my focus and my involvement. So it was just a pleasure to be exposed to all of this history. So yeah, let's start with how did you go about doing the research for this? And I think you also did some interviews. You actually got to talk to some people and you're looking at, so yeah, tell us all about that.
Yeah. I really came at it as an independent scholar. I have a bachelor's in sociology, and that's where I stopped my formal education, but I am always learning. I'm always reading. I'm always finding out about things, getting new fascinations and new obsessions. And, you know, even at the wizened old age of 62, I find myself still very much out there just trying to get information. Somebody said, well, Mike, that's because you're a Scorpio rat. That's like the ideal combination for a researcher, to, for your zodiac and Chinese birth signs to be that pairing. And I've always been like that. I came at it really from an interest in alternative and non-traditional spiritual groups. I've been involved in some myself over the years, not just hanging out with the entheogen users, but with other ones as well. And really, the thing that kicked it off for me was in the mid-80s, discovering J. Gordon Melton's Encyclopedia of American Religion, which is this fantastic catalog of everything from the Roman Catholic Church all the way down to the craziest sects that you can imagine, all described very, you know, very objectively as an academic work. It's been updated several times since it first came out in the late 70s. And as I said earlier, this is where my my fascination in particular with the entheogenic groups came from. A lot of it has just been book collecting, collecting ephemera, doing lots and lots of research in research libraries. A really invaluable one is the Institute for a Study of American Religion library at UC Santa Barbara. Of course, the internet has been an absolute godsend, particularly, and I'm going to give a shout out to one of my favorites, which is archive.org, just a fantastic free resource. And some of it was just through serendipity, too. I mean, one of the groups I cover in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches, which is Naturalism Incorporated, also known as the Church of Naturalism, I just saw some vague reference to somewhere, and I said, well, what's this about? And I started gathering information about that from some fairly obscure sources, and I said, my God, this is you know, this warrants in a chapter in the book in and of itself. It's really, I guess I just have a knack for it. I have a knack for ferreting out obscure information, both online and certainly, I've done some interviews with some people in the field. I'd say the most interesting one in many ways was a 3-hour talk I did with James Mooney, who founded the Eclava Native American Church in Utah. And I, in the book, I call him probably the most prolific psychedelic church planter in history, because at one point he had chartered several hundred of these groups under his corporate banner. He had to pull a lot of their charters though after a while, because so many of them were having big legal problems and personal problems. And I get into some of the really colorful and bizarre stories in the book about that. But he very very sincere man, very interesting man, interesting life. And he turns 80 next year. And that was an example of one person who just provided plenty of fascinating information. Another person I'll give a shout out to is Carl Hassell, who was for many years was a member of the Peyote Way Church of God in Arizona, which was probably the first peyote using or even entheogenic church to really have state authorities anyway say, we'll look the other way if non-Indians are participating. Up until then, the understanding was the only legal way you can use peyote in the United States is if you were a member of the Native American Church. And to be an official member of the Native American Church, you have to be able to prove that you're at least one quarter Indian, with family trees going back to enrolled tribes. Carl was just, who was involved with the Peyote Way Church of God, was fairly close to their founder, Emmanuel Trujillo, who's a fascinating character I talk about in psychedelic cults and outlaw churches who just has not been, is this guy who just went from one wild activity to another, all of which is documented, but has never, the story has never really been told until now. I think it's a combination of things for me, of just being able to kind of smoke out these interesting and strange little stories about this this religious underworld underground, which is slowly emerging from the underground and kind of has its sights set on the mainstream now, I think.
Yeah, you know, a few different interesting things that kind of come up in different ways in the book is sort of the ways that these entheogenic churches and religions, that they kind of follow in the footsteps of a lot of religion in America, where religion in America has really been an experimental culture, where there's been so many different branches of Christianity branching off from each other and new religious organizations and movements and things. And so we can see the same thing here, where one person branches off from one group and then someone else branches off later. And then also there are very colorful characters, as you say, and some have very different agendas. Some are coming from, we could say, a very spiritual approach, and others are kind of more cultural disruptors of looking to agitate society. So there's not like just one kind of church founder here. There really is quite a diversity, and little one-off cults, and then also ones that have, you know, basic, they have these lineages and disagreements and doctrinal differences.
And they're, even within the Native American Church, which is easily the oldest, largest, and most established of all of them, it, last statistics I said there may be as many as 500,000 members who are all Native Americans who regularly do peyote ceremonies. Even they've had controversy, and they've really done most of the heavy lifting, I think, legally, because they spent almost a century fighting the U.S. and state and tribal governments to be able to legally consume peyote buttons in their ceremonies. I think that's just human tendency. You get a group of people together and the group mind kind of takes over. And sometimes the group mind is not really unified, or there'll be disruptions in it, or people with different ideas, and they split off. I mean, even the early Christian church, if you look at the epistles and, that was divided and had controversies and had problems. This is just, you know, again, this is the sociologist in me talking. This is, I think, human nature. We need community, but at the same time, those communities can be very volatile.
Yeah, and especially when we have various charismatic figures, various figures who may be imbalanced in certain ways, and certainly there are characters that have different agendas that they're looking to enact through these activities of establishing churches, but also, you know, disrupting and changing society, that it's it's just, there's a lot of dynamic elements in all of these stories that you're sharing here.
One thing I was going to point out as a, you know, very an element that is just very obvious in this world and really contributes to trouble is the fact that until very recently, all of these substances were extremely legal throughout North America. Of course, there's been a lot of change in the laws about cannabis at the state level. Cannabis is now completely legal in Canada. And there's, of course, these moves right now to decriminalize psilocybin and use MDMA in therapy. But it's somebody once who was reviewing the manuscript has said, Mike, almost all the leaders of these groups and founders are male. Why is that? And I said, well, we're in outlaw territory. That's where men go. It's women tend to hang back a bit more, and unless this they have really extraordinary circumstances, this is more where this area of where you're not really in respectable society anymore. In fact, you're probably violating laws that can get you thrown into the joint for years. This tends to be a male thing. Go out there and be an explorer. Go out there and be a renegade. it's changing, certainly. There are a couple of rather prominent women in that world that I discuss in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches, but we're really talking about a phenomenon where you have to be kind of crazy and kind of a rebel and kind of a troublemaker to begin with to found your own religion. And when it is when it is involved with something that is illegal to begin with, then you really, I think, are in strange waters and very rough waters. The only groups I would possibly compare the entheogenic churches in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches to would be, say, the Snake Handlers, the Signs Following Pentecostals up in Appalachia, or perhaps some of the more hardcore Santeria and African diasporic groups throughout the Caribbean that do animal sacrifices. This is outlaw territory. This is where you're really, it is great faith and great risk that is happening in these places. And you are going to attract the attention of the law, and it is not going to be good. And you're going to be martyred if only as a, through an arrest and maybe some jail time or fines. And I just discuss the, in the book, I discuss the constant legal problems these groups have had, which I think will become less of an issue as the laws change and as society becomes a little more accepting of the entheogens as a spiritual practice.
Yeah, and a lot of the different churches and cults and temples that are mentioned in the book, these were all established and formed, you know, back in the 60s, back in the 70s, and all of this was before the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was in response to the peyote case here in Oregon, where basically the right to practice your religion was kind of stripped by the Supreme Court. So then Congress created the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And so people who are building their churches now, they're working on a very different platform, legally speaking. And also with some of these cults and churches, they started with LSD while it was still legal, then it became illegal. And then that's where we get a lot of these very colorful, transformative characters. And as you say, it does seem to be very male. And this is also another difference that we see with a lot of the new churches that are being built and established. Many of them are being founded by women. And they're not looking to be necessarily big cultural disruptors. It's not like we've got to overthrow the man, we've got to overthrow the system. It's like, no, we just want to claim our religious right and we want to have our ceremonies here in our temple. So the motivations are very different as well.
Yeah. Although one can say those motivations were there in the beginning, whether with the Native American church, when it first really got peyoteism really got going among North American tribes at the end of the 19th century, or with in the 50s and early 60s when LSD and psilocybin and mescaline-bearing peyote plants were still legal. And people outside of the indigenous communities, and this would have been scientists and the beatniks and the early hippies and people who were just exploring things, had these incredible experiences and said, we just want to be free to have them.
Yeah.
But the hammer came down on them, and that's when they started getting more militant and getting more, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and this is very much what happened in San Francisco in 65, 66, when the hippies were beginning. They just wanted to be left alone and smoke dope and dance to psychedelic rock music and live together communally. But the law and public opprobrium caught up with them. And once they started feeling the heat of that, they got into the militant politics. And this is, again, it's a kind of cycle these groups go through. I think that's, and also the, how can I put it here? The fashions change, cultural fashions changed. I think a lot of this stuff really was a fever pitch in the mid and late 60s. And then fell off very fast when consciousness expansion kind of went out of fashion in the 70s. And as I explain in the book, psychedelic cults and outlaw churches. God, I don't know the name of my own book. In the 90s, the children of the hippies kind of rediscovered all this stuff. You had the rave culture. You had the beginning of Burning Man. You had this whole kind of neo-hippie with the Grateful Dead becoming the biggest live act in the world in the late 80s and early 90s. You had this kind of revival. And with that, you had a revival in the interest of using entheogens as for spiritual growth. And you start seeing some new groups pop up. So that's it's really something that as an observer of the fringe in its many different forms, it's something that's always intrigued me. Is it where do they come from and how do they deal with it once they've got attention? And did they get repressed? Did they get ignored? Do they decide to really sell out and commercialize the whole thing, which I think is happening to a certain extent right now in the psychedelic world, is that the big pharma is very much interested in these substances and what will become of them and the culture around them remains to be seen. But that's I know I'm kind of tapering off here, but that's just it's a very good point. It's a very good observation.
Yeah. So the book itself, you could say it seems to be, I'm just looking at it now, well, it's divided into two parts. And so we have part one, we have the major sects, and then part two, the minor sects. And again, there are entries in both of these two different parts of the book that were new to me. I'd never heard of them before. So in terms of like dividing these into major and minor, what were some of your criteria for deciding who goes in which section of the book? And certainly it seems like a lot of the major ones, they have a longer history and more involvement in the culture overall versus in the minor sects. Some of them you even mentioned like, well, this exists online. We haven't really seen anywhere. But yeah, so talk a little bit about that in terms of dividing them. And of course, you did start, you know, with the historical precedent of the Native American church. Yeah.
In North America, it all begins with them. That was really the beginning of the peyote use in North America goes back about 7,000 years at least. It kind of came up, it was mostly in Mexico until about 100 years ago when I go into the process that brought it up to North America in the book. They've been around as an organized group since 1918. The other 17 groups that I look at in the part one, the major groups, are groups that may not have lasted as long, but lasted for a while, several years at least, had membership that was visible and quantifiable, produced books or a fair amount of ephemera about what they were doing, and had some media attention. The part two, which is the minor groups, and there's about 47 or 48 in that section. These are more like interesting little blips on the radar of this world. Some of them are unbelievably obscure. And then you have others like, Temple 420 in Southern California, which is Craig Rubin's, organization. They are a cannabis using Judeo-Christian syncretistic sect, and I've known Craig for many years. Really good guy, and he got a lot of media attention in the 90s and the 00s for his various activities. But they still kind of ended up there because it hadn't quite them and a few others. It was more, a little more ephemeral than the groups than the groups in part one. A little less established. So that was really it there. It was just longevity. Did you produce literature? Did you have an actual membership that could be verified of followers? And what kind of media attention were you getting, if any? That was what decided whether you were going to go in the front or the back.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about some of these different ones. I'm particularly interested for you to share when we get into the major sects here about ones that perhaps people haven't really heard of before. Which ones that are kind of interesting for you that's like, wow, this is a weird one, or this one's got some good stories about it. I mean, just to share with the audience here, we have the Native American Church. We've talked a little bit about that. We have the Church of the Awakening, the Paiute Way Church of God, the Oklavua Native American Church, the League for Spiritual Discovery, the Neo-American Church, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, Shiva Lila, the Church of Naturalism, the Church of the Tree of Life, Temple of the True Inner Light, the Shiva Fellowship, the Psychedelic Venus Church, the Ethiopian Zion Coptic Church, which that's one I'd never heard of. That, you know, I'm well familiar with Rastafari culture, but I'd not specifically heard of that church. And we have the Church of the Universe, the Hawaii Cannabis Ministry, the International Church of Cannabis, and Ayahuasca Healings, which actually what I wanted to mention when you referenced that earlier, that I remember a few years ago and seeing on Facebook this group Ayahuasca Healings, and they're putting out ads on Facebook saying, come to Washington and legally drink ayahuasca. And I was just really surprised by that. You know, I live here in Ashland, Oregon, where we have the Church of the Holy Light of the Queen, which is the Santo Daime Church, which they went to court to be able to legally drink ayahuasca. And this ayahuasca healing group comes out and they said, yeah, we have the first legal ayahuasca consumption in the United States. I was like, I don't think you've been to court, you know. So anyway, so that's the list of what you have here.
Yeah. Trinity de Guzman, who's a fascinating young man, who founded Ayahuasca Healings, is a master of self-promotion. And I get into his whole campaign and his whole career in psychedelic cults and outlaw churches. You mentioned Santo Daime. Yes, they and another church whose name I always forget and can't pronounce the Portuguese anyway, both have missions in the United States, and both and their missions can legally consume ayahuasca here because both the Oregon Supreme Court in the case of Santo Daime and the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of the other one said, well, these are based in traditional Brazilian syncretistic indigenous beliefs. So they have a heritage. They have a these are the real thing. So yeah, we'll let them have a couple little missions in the U.S. A group coming out of the U.S. out of nowhere is in a very different situation. I mean, that's why eventually, after many legal struggles, the federal government eventually had to say to with the Native American Church, yeah, freedom of religion. You guys have been doing this for however long. This is an indigenous practice, whatever. It's a very different situation when you just decide that these are going to be your religious sacraments and you want to form a church or a circle or whatever and have it legally recognized. Where were we? I'm sorry, I ramble a lot, but
no, that's quite all right.
As far as interesting groups or groups people haven't heard of, well, and are we still there?
We blipped out for a second. Yeah, we had a little blip there, but you're about to say in terms of interesting groups.
Oh yeah. Well, an interesting individual, a man who I actually knew, both a very intelligent and creative and a deeply, deeply disturbed and messed up guy at the same time, who is in several, kind of in and out of the narrative and psychedelic cults and outlaw churches, was the late Jefferson Poland. He was involved with the Neo-American Church, which was the group that shared the Millbrook Estate in upstate New York, along with Timothy Leary's League for Spiritual Discovery. And they have a wild history. The man who founded it was, like Leary, an ex-psychologist, and his name was Art Kleps. And he was I see in the introduction of the chapter about them, if Timothy Leary was the ringmaster of the 60s psychedelic circus, Art Kleps was the wild man and clown. He just ran the whole organization as a like half seriously. Priests were called boohoos. The symbol was a three-eyed toad. But at the same time, it was dead serious about, yes, LSD will enlighten you, and this is our practice, and to the government, F you if you don't like it. Poland had gotten involved with him. He'd also started his own group called the Fellowship of the Clear Light. Then he was involved with the Shiva Fellowship in San Francisco, which was an attempt to start cannabis-based Shaivite or worship of Shiva in the United States. And they may have invented 420. And I get into that in the book. They one of their first big appearances in Golden Gate Park in 1968 was a ceremony on, was at a fair on 420, where they handed out joints to all the attendees and taught them how to smoke them as a devotion to Shiva. They have a really interesting history. Their leader got thrown in prison. I discussed the story behind that in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches. And Jefferson Poland spun off his own group with a lot of the followers from that, called the Psychedelic Venus Church, which was just, you talk about agitation. I mean, their whole thing, their whole belief was, we're worshiping the goddess through using cannabis in public nudity, and sacred sex orgies in private. And the chapter, I think, was the most fun to write, because there was just so much crazy stuff I dug up about them. And I am actually, was actually helped on that by the, not only by in the years I knew Poland, he would tell stories about it, but his lieutenant, Mother Boats, who is still with us, also had a lot of very interesting anecdotes about that. Apparently they would, I get into just the crazy rituals they would have in early 70s San Francisco, where they would hire a hall and have like three rock bands playing on the stage, all naked, and everybody was dosed on LSD spiked punch, and there were orgies and just crazy stuff. And I get into it, the stories behind that in the book. That's somebody who just, he's like the Zelig of the Bay Area counterculture. He was just in all these important places at different times, but not very few people have actually heard about him. Another group I already mentioned earlier was the Church of Naturalism. George Peters started that in Chicago as an LSD rescue service back in the old days, before harm reduction, before all the groups now that deal with people at raves and parties and burning and whatever that are having bad trips. Nobody really knew about this. Nobody could do anything about it. The psychiatric and medical fields were just completely hands off. So people started volunteering themselves as guides to people who were having bad experiences on acid or whatever. One of them was this character, George Peters, who just has a really strange, enigmatic background. Nobody really knows, has been able to dig up much about the guy, and lots of contradictory information. And it eventually became a religion for him. And he and his, they migrated from Chicago to LA in the 70s, and he and his second in command were brutally murdered in Laurel Canyon, Los Angeles, in 1982. And nobody, I mean, we've all heard about the Four on the Floor murder, the Wonderland murders in Laurel Canyon, that in 1981, John Holmes was mixed up with. There's lots of stories about all the crazy stuff that's going on in Laurel Canyon as kind of a center of LA weirdness. This stuff has never been out there before. I had to dig really deep into newspaper articles of the time to find this, that there this really bad, ugly double murder involving a cult. In the backyard of the American entertainment and media industry not too long ago. That's another example. I really, in the more familiar groups with the Native American Church, with Leary, millions of words have been written about them. So I really tried to just boil it down to the essentials, bring everything up to date. And with Leary, I just concentrated mostly, there's several good bios of him out there. I concentrated mostly on his work running organizations that used LSD first as a substance for psychological experimentation, then as an aid to, and that would have been the IFIF, and then as an aid for therapy, and that would have been the Castalia Foundation, and then finally as a religious sacrament that they wanted to have the First Amendment right to be able to use, and that organization was the League for Spiritual Discovery. So yeah, it's this is the result of many, many years of digging and looking at all these things that have just kind of been thrown into the memory hole from the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. It's a subculture that has just not been explored in the way that I did it in psychedelic cults and outlaw churches. And I know I keep saying it, but I'm just really pleased at how the book came out, how the project came out, and how we've now got all this stuff documented in one place.
Yeah. And I think some of the obscurity is probably due to the fact that a lot of these churches, probably most of them, they didn't last. Yeah. People ended up in prison, personality disagreements, you know, quote unquote doctrinal disagreements, things fell apart, things got too wild, things got out of hand. Yeah. So they didn't necessarily have like the staying power of, say, the Native American Church, which, as you say, has been around for over 100 years. There's no indication that the Native American Church is going anywhere, that they're a fundamental part of Native American culture at this point. But a lot of this stuff, as you say, was really experimental. It wasn't based on anything that necessarily came before, even when, like with, you mentioned these Shiva worshiping groups, that they want to worship Lord Shiva. His favorite plant is cannabis, ganja in Sanskrit. And, that's has an ancient lineage in India, but, white people smoking pot in the United States, they don't have that ancient lineage of cannabis consumption. So it was still kind of, it was new in that sense. It was created based on the idea of this lineage, but it wasn't really present. So of these major sects that are mentioned here, other than Native American Church, are any of these like still around and active?
Peyote Way Church of God is still going. The Oklava Native American Church is still happening. Roger Christie, who runs the Hawaiian Cannabis Ministry in out of the Big Island in Hawaii, he's one of the great martyrs for entheogenic religion. He spent 4 years in federal lockup in Honolulu with no trial, no contact with media, didn't even get to go out of the building. His ministry, he told me very recently, he's partly because of the influence of my book, he's considering starting it up again. And I think also because of the laws beginning to change. A lot of them. Trinity de Guzman is now running his retreats out of Peru and Mexico, and he's not only doing ayahuasca, but he's also doing bufotenin and the arrow frog poison and a couple of other substances as part of the whole menu of entheogens that are offered in those experiences. So a lot of this is history, but a lot of this is groups that are still out there and still active.
Yeah. So let's talk about the chosen sacraments for a minute. So it does seem like in part one, with the larger and kind of the older crop of churches and groups, the main players seem to be peyote, LSD, and cannabis. Mm-hmm. And then as we get into these more minor sects and cults, a lot of them are a bit more recent in their development, and things really branch out there in terms of like isn't there like a couple in here that are about Salvia divinorum?
Like they, yeah. That's they're in part two because they those groups never really kind of got legs. They were largely internet based and were pretty obscure. An example of groups that got into more obscure psychoactive substances, a good one would have been the Church of the Tree of Life, which came out of San Francisco. Their whole rationale was, okay, the Native American church was able to grandfather in an exemption to their people for the use of peyote. Let's go and find psychoactive substances that haven't been made illegal yet, declare them as our sacraments. And so if they are made illegal, we'll try to get that same exemption that the NAC does. And they actually did some very interesting work kind of bringing this stuff to these very obscure substances to light for the first time. This is the first time in the hippie culture and whatever many people had ever heard of kava. And of course, kava is very trendy now in kava bars. That was one of their sacraments. They were one of the first sources where hippies and trippers and whomever heard that San Pedro cactus contains mescaline, and they in their office in San Francisco where their founder John Mann lives, he used to sell cuttings to people who would come by and give them instructions on how to boil it down to extract the mescaline out of it. And that's an example of one where they got into more less well-known substances, I think partly as a legal strategy. And and then you had another really interesting group I discuss in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches is the Temple of the True Inner Light in New York City. They had kind of an interesting history. They grew out of the Yippies, the Youth International Party, who were the sort of culture jamming and media pranking hardline new left group of the late 60s and early 70s. And they eventually evolved into this group that used DPT, which is a legal synthetic empathogen, which I think was first developed by the legendary Alexander Shulgin. And for many years, they had a storefront church in the East Village where an adult could go in there and have a quick interview with the church members there. And if they approved of you, they would sit you down with a hookah and you would smoke raspberry leaves that were impregnated with the DPT, and you would have a very short-term but very powerful entheogenic experience. And they were completely ignored by the law. And I think the reason was the law was just too busy at that time dealing with the heroin and cocaine trade. They didn't care about a couple handfuls of hippies on some weird legal psychedelic. And yeah, they have very, very interesting beliefs and practices too. And I get into those in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches.
Yeah. So many different interesting groups. And certainly a big issue with a lot of these groups was around distribution, that not only were they like saying, this is our church, but they're like, especially a lot of the LSD churches, they're going out and they're just like passing this stuff out. And as you say, like these big orgies and rock concerts and everybody's being dosed, which is just, you know, we see some echoes of that at Burning Man, but we live in a culture now where the idea of like, where you're just dosing everyone, that's like, no way. Nothing like that would ever happen. Or at least if it did happen, it would be so roundly criticized that even the culture that wouldn't accept that. And I mean, like psychedelic culture, which is like, hey, that's really uncool. Yeah. That, you know, a lot of things have shifted so that these earlier groups that had sort of this freewheeling, like, yeah, we're just going to dose everyone. We're going to give LSD to anybody who wants it. It's a very different ethos than people are working from today.
Yeah. Well, the classic example of a group like that that I discuss in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches is the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. They started out as basically a bunch of Orange County hoodlums who discovered LSD and had their lives changed around completely and decided that they were going to be a religious brotherhood and turn the entire world on to the chemical. They were the ones behind the development of the variant of LSD called Orange Sunshine. And even though they were They were making a lot of money smuggling and selling cannabis and hashish, but much of their LSD distribution was free. They would give away fistfuls of these of doses at rock concerts and parties and whatever in the late 60s. And they have an absolutely absorbing history. It's been written up in a couple of books, and I've kind of boiled it down to a few thousand words and the essentials of their story in the book. And they are still around in a sense in that there's still a few brothers around who I don't know if they do any ceremonies or anything. I don't think so, but they kind of, they have websites and books about their experiences, and they're kind of the old veterans of the psychedelic revolution. And one of the funny things about them is I know several of them, and all of them claim that, I was in the Brotherhood, but that guy isn't. And he's phony, whatever. And they all say that about each other. I mean, it's funny to just see these old acid heads squabbling over, oh yeah, I'm the real thing. You're not. Again, human nature.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's just kind of reflecting on that, that one of the things that I really enjoy about this book is that it is bringing this sort of forgotten history to light and making it all accessible. And that it's interesting that so much of this is, in a sense, been forgotten or never really documented. But a lot of these people, they're still around. I mean, they're very much at the end of their years. But, yeah. You know, it's not so long ago, in other words, that the people who started this stuff, some of them are still around. They're still interested in this. So it's not ancient history. Yeah. It's history enough that most of us don't really know a lot of the details that are available in this book. Uh-huh. But it's not like we're looking at 300 years ago, 400 years ago. Yeah. So it's still part of living culture in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are just certain parts of human history that can just be mined forever, I think, and really the 60s, 70s, the whole kind of countercultural explosion of the time, and the 50s before that with the Beats, is one of those. I mean, so much of it has already been discussed, but there is still so much more, like what I talk about in Psychedelic Cults and Outlaw Churches, that hasn't been, that's obscure. And if you're a writer or a academic or a social historian or whatever, now's the time to start doing the interviews and the work on this, because again, the people who are involved in this stuff are still with us, and it would be good to get their accounts before they go to the light.
Yeah, we want to preserve access to those primary sources. So now, Mike, what are you doing in terms of, I know just from seeing on Facebook that you just recently had, I believe, you had a book signing and maybe reading in the Bay Area, there's San Francisco, Oakland, something like that. But what are you planning for promotion of the book and to help let people know that it's out there?
I actually haven't done any signings yet. The first one is going to be on Saturday, July 22nd. 2 to 4 p.m. at the Psychedelic San Francisco Gallery, which is a gallery largely made up of the art of Mark McLeod, who pioneered the medium of blotter tabs as an art form. His art there does not have any of the secret sauce in it, unfortunately, but it can be very striking.
So don't lick the art, anyone.
Don't lick the art. It won't. Yeah, it won't get you off, and it'll just piss off the people there. So I'm going to be there. Yeah, Saturday, July 22nd, 2 to 4, and then the Saturday after that, the 29th, I am going to be doing a signing and an actual PowerPoint display and presentation of visuals that did not make it into the book from these groups, at Open Secret Bookstore in San Rafael, which is just a wonderful, wonderful bookstore and sort of metaphysical community center. And I'm lining up more appearances after that too. I mean, really kind of the first wave of publicity I'm doing is going on podcasts like yours and discussing the book with interested folks and letting your listenership know about it and about what's in it, and maybe they can go out there and buy copies and read it for themselves and just hear these really unique and usually untold stories about this psychedelic subculture.
Yeah. Anybody who wants the backstory on kind of the modern psychedelic movement, I think that this is probably a must read. And, you know, we're recording this a few weeks before it's going to be released. So the events that you've mentioned, they probably will have already happened by the time that the listeners get to this. But I would want to invite you to, you know, send me the list of upcoming events that you're going to be participating in or where you're going to be sharing the book. And we can, of course, promote it for when this interview actually does come out so that people can be up to date on that. But it's a great book, Mike. I really enjoyed it. It's just a really fascinating read, and I think it's just well organized. And yeah, I was really happy to receive it, and it's just been a pleasure to talk to you about it. It's obviously something that you found a lot of enjoyment in researching and putting together, and it's just nice to hear sort of your enthusiasm for the whole project and being able to share sort of this overlooked section of history with everyone.
Okay. Well, I thank you for having me on, Martin. I mean, you have a really interesting podcast and very intelligent questions and sort of exchange with me. And I really hope that you and your listeners have enjoyed my my talk here. I know I have a tendency to ramble and go off on tangents, but it is something that has fascinated me for many years, and I hope it fascinates your listeners as well.
Well, I'm sure that it will. Thank you so much for your time, Mike.
Okay. Thank you, Martin.